Today we get the guy who runs the show, the skipper, John Farrell, and he is here to take your phone calls, 416-870-0590, star 590 on the cell, and long distance, 1-888-666-0590. And John, first of all, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it in what's got to be, you know, your time to kick back and relax in the off season before things start to get going. Have you been watching these playoffs? Have you been just checking them out, or have you been deeply involved, or neither?
No, I've been watching. It's been interesting to see what's, you know, unfolded to date. You know, I think every season you go into not only spring training, but not just with our club, but around baseball, everyone talks about how tough the American League East is, and yet after the first round, there's no one left from the American League East. So if anything that comes out of this one, out of this postseason, you could say that parity has clearly arrived in baseball.
Yeah, that's certainly one argument you can make. You could also say best of fives really don't prove, you know, which team is better. And you've been through those playoff series, those short series, and they have to be. I mean, I don't want to say you have to be lucky to win, but they can turn on pretty much anything.
They can turn, but at the same time, I think five games gives enough of a series to where you're going to test the strengths and weaknesses of a given team. I think if you look at the clubs that are in the playoffs right now, and certainly the two teams that are left, but when you go back to the eight teams that did get in, you're going to look at the top three starters and really kind of get a gauge of how deep their rotation is. What we're seeing in this World Series is probably different than many in the past, is that the bullpens have become such a prominent role.
Yep.
And the starting rotations have become less of a factor, but those rotations got them to postseason to begin with.
They certainly did. Do you like the fact that they've eliminated what I used to refer to lovingly as the stupid extra off day between game four and five of those seven game series? I thought at that point, and they instituted that because of a whole bunch of rainouts a few years back, you didn't even need three starting pitchers, and you could use your top reliever five times in a seven game series. Dialing that back, has that made it more like real baseball?
Yeah, it has, for sure, Mike. I think as we talked about the five-game series, does it give you a true glimpse? You make the argument that the seven-game series with the previous format is less of a test than a five-game series. So this is much better. I mean, it's baseball, as we all know, is a sport where you got to play regularly to get a rhythm. And I think the one thing that we found out a couple of years ago, being in, you know, through the World Series and into the ALCS, is that when those off days arrive, you know, you get out of rhythm a little bit. And, I think everybody's so accustomed to playing every day that this is a better format.
Well, we saw that, too, when you were with the Red Sox in the World Series against the Rockies, because you were there for that one, not the Cardinals one, right?
Yeah, right. You're right.
And they were off like nine days off, right?
Yeah, they had 9 days off. And you know what? That worked against them. They swept the NLCS, and they're sitting around waiting for us to get done. We went seven against Cleveland. So the condensed format does everybody a world of good. Hopefully you run into less inclement weather, even though tonight in St. Louis is going to be raining in the mid-40s. I think the more condensed, the better for everybody.
Agreed. We are with Blue Jays skipper John Farrell. So are you watching and kind of like everybody else managing along with it, or can you turn that part of your brain off after doing it for 162 games?
I think, no, you don't turn that off. That's just because, you know, that's kind of part of who we become. And, the fact is we've got a number of Blue Jays in this series, and to think what Dotel and Zapchinski are doing for St. Louis, those two guys have completed their bullpen. And given those specialists, both right-handed and left-handed, I think to kind of get them where they are, because when you look at the number of innings that their starters have thrown, I think it's the fewest in Major League history to get to the point where they're at now. So it's, you do manage along, but then there's a personal connection with the guys that are in this series.
And do you take a point of pride in it because you're the guy, and I don't know if it was just you or you and Bruce Walton and Pat Henken and Alex Anthopoulos, but you're the guy who said, you know what, let's make Zep into that late inning lefty.
That was a conversation, and certainly Happy and Bruce, he had more history with Zep than anybody. Alex has obviously seen him since the day he signed all the way through the minor leagues, and he's had some good starts along the way. But I think there was a common feeling that with his delivery, his arm action in particular, that he would be best suited for the bullpen because shorter stints, it was always that maybe the later portion of the second time through a lineup or the third time through where he'd start to lose his command at times. But when you're looking at a guy who can sink the ball at 92, 93 and have above average breaking ball to wipe out a left-hander, you know, those guys are invaluable. And we saw what happened after he left us. You know, that's an area that specialized area, particularly left on left, is a critical role.
I have a feeling Zepchinski may pitch against Josh Hamilton in every game of this World Series.
Well, based on what's taken place already, Mike, you're going to say, yeah, he's going to save him for that slot, you know, every time he comes up, because you look at the amount of right-handers in behind Hamilton, and that's where Dotel is going to come in. The two keys for me are going to be Ogando for Texas and Dotel for St. Louis, because they're going to pitch those critical innings and those key outs somewhere in that, you know, to finish out a threat, a sixth, all the way through into the eighth inning. And those guys are going to be on the spotlight many times in this series.
Yeah, it is going to be a blast to watch. Do you have a favorite?
Well, you know, the conventional pick or the, you know, maybe the educated pick is to go with Texas because of maybe a more complete team. But you know what St. Louis has done over the last 6 weeks? They've played with their backs against the wall every single night. And whether it's the squirrel, whether it's something else, they've got a hell of a lot of momentum and a hell of a lot of belief in them because they've overcome a huge deficit late August through September, and they've continued to carry it through in the postseason. And, you know, this is going to come down to how well the bullpens pitch. So I'm not dancing around your question. Conventional wisdom would say Texas, but I think, you know, St. Louis is well positioned to give them everything they've got. And the thing about it is, they've got home field advantage. That might come into play in the series.
And how amazing is it that they have home field advantage because Prince Fielder hit a 3-run home run in the All-Star game off of C.J. Wilson?
Yeah, a lot of subplots in this one. Listen to you hope this series goes 7 games because I heard you at the outset. This is your Blue Jays pregame show, and without the series going full 7, you're going to be a few shows short of a full slate here.
It's true. I want to get the entire 25-man roster on, so yeah. We have to go.
Good
luck, man. We have to go 7 games. Before we get to the calls, I want to ask you about one guy who we will not have on the Blue Jay Day pregame show, even if this series goes 7, and that's Colby Rasmus, because when I asked Colby for his number, he gave it to me, but he said it's not going to work in the woods, which is where he's spending October. You talk about the bullpen, we talk about Zepp and Dotel, and every night throughout the NLCS, we've gotten the call, you know, wow, did the Blue Jays really give up a ton? Man, Colby Rasmus, it's a huge bust. And we've seen it. We saw him healthy for 3 weeks, and then after the wrist injury came back and didn't do well. What do you say to the fans who are pounding it into us every day that Colby Rasmus hasn't worked out when we're just in the infancy of his career as a Blue Jay?
Well, I think you surmised it right there, the infancy of his career. I think the one thing that we can't overlook, and this goes for a guy who is, you know, 30 years old, 10 years with an organization, or 24 years old, and he's in his fourth or fifth year with a team. When that guy makes his first move through a trade to another club, it's an unsettling situation. And I know people might say, well, you know what, you're major league players, you should be able to put that out, you should go out and play the game to your capabilities. That's one argument. The other one is, you know, there's a human element to this, and this guy went through a lot while in St. Louis, and then the change to Toronto was unsettling. That has happened, and that's documented time and time again. The one thing that when we met at the end of the season, I'll tell you this, when the staff met with Alex and his staff to review the club, the one thing that we continued to stress was we went back through the scouting process to identify Colby to acquire him. That hasn't changed. We believe in that process. This player, Colby, did not change on the flight to Toronto. He is going to be the player that we saw scouted and acquired before coming to Toronto when we get to spring training and beyond. Yes, are there adjustments that are needed? Sure. Every player's got adjustments as they go through facing pitchers for the first time. That's no different here. Colby's going to work hard every day to get better. But I think he'll come into spring training knowing that he's a Blue Jay rather than a guy that's a Cardinal wondering if I'm going elsewhere.
And we look forward to seeing that because there is a ton of talent there. There are a lot of people lined up.
He's a hell of a talent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to see it. And the like you said, and I've said this to a couple of people already, history did not begin on July 27th, 2011. This guy had a heck of a resume prior to becoming a Blue Jay.
Without a doubt. The physical skills are there. There's no question. And it's a matter of just, one, regaining the comfort that he felt from day one coming out of the draft as a first-round pick with the Cardinals. And I'm confident, I think we're all confident, that he'll settle in and he'll be the talent that Alex acquired. And you don't lose bat speed overnight. You don't lose range in the outfield overnight. And those skills are still there. It's our job as a staff to continue to make that as consistent as possible.
We are with Blue Jays manager John Farrell, who has graciously said, call him up, let's talk. And as we do with our Blue Jay A Day pregame throughout the entirety of the postseason, we got a ton of people lined up who want to talk to John Farrell. So we do have a couple of lines open at 416-870-0590. Star 590 on the cell. Long distance is 1-888-666-0590. And I got to tell you, John, the Leafs are playing right now. So the fact that we have a lot of callers for you speaks very highly of you. So congratulations.
What do they do?
The Leafs? I'm not sure. We try.
I hear you.
We try to ignore them as much as we can on the baseball side. It's only fair they ignore us too. But at least your players seem to enjoy them. So that's a good thing. We're having a lot of convergence here with all the sports teams in the city, and hopefully they can all start winning pretty soon. But let's get to the phones. People want to talk to the skipper. Tim is in Aurora. Tim, say hello to John Farrell.
Hey, John, how you doing? Pleasure to be talking to you.
Tim, good to talk to you as well. How are you?
Not too bad. My question for you is, I was just wondering what kind of relationship you have with Alex Anthopoulos, and what kind of input do you put into trades and free agent acquisitions and all that? I know this would be your first free agency period, but how did your relationship grow over the year as well?
Our relationship is one that's there's conversation, communication daily. And I think the thing that I value the most is how honest and nothing is held back. I think we've had some disagreements. We've had differing views of given players or ways to address maybe a challenge that we're facing at the time. And I think not being inhibited to give what your thought is and your true opinion, that gives us the best chance to arrive at what I would think the best possible answer for the given situation. So that's been free-flowing. He gives us our space, which I completely appreciate. And yet I'll preempt some things with some thoughts that I have that are coming up, let's say for a series or trying to give some guys some rest. So I think we try to stay ahead of the curve as much as possible, but, I'm awful thankful for the relationship that we've started out with.
Is there a lot of, I'm assuming there is a lot of back and forth because you both have opinions and like you said, you're open enough that you can express it with each other. But is there a lot of why'd you do this and would you do this again and that kind of game by game minutia with the managerial moves?
There can be. If there are situations that really stick out, he'll want to know, hey, what were you thinking here? Or, you know what, I thought of doing it this way. And then we'll walk through and talk about the different options that existed in the moment and what the ramifications might have been for each one. So that's where his opinions, his questions, they're not threatening, but I think he deserves the right to know. Ultimately, he's responsible. Granted, I'm responsible for what goes on in-game, on the field, and in the clubhouse, but ultimately he's responsible for the day-to-day of the entire organization. So those questions are welcomed, and it's really – generated a lot of debate and a lot of good conversation many times.
I've always wondered, I've known Alex since he started with the Blue Jays, probably 8-9 years, 10 years, but this is someone who, when you were pitching in the big leagues, he was 10 years old. And someone who has a baseball background behind the scenes and went to scout school and did all of that stuff, but never obviously played at any elite level, and he's not new to that. I mean, you were with Theo Epstein in Boston, and you were in a front office in Cleveland as well. But does that stuff even get thought of anymore, or have we gone too far the last 8-10 years with so many of the Alex types in the game that it's just, okay, this is the guy, he's the GM, and it doesn't matter, and let's go from there? Or do they still have to, do people who never grew up in the culture of Major League Baseball, do they still have to kind of prove things to those who did with the way they think the game and the way they can talk about it?
Good question. I'm sure every situation is going to be based on the individual. The one thing that Alex does very well is he listens. And he gains as much information as he can. He respects people's opinion. That's the one thing that has really stood out to me in the 12 months that we've been working together. His respect for others, and knows that there's different ways of looking at something. There's not one absolute. That's why he seeks to get as many opinions as possible and formulate the best decision that he can. He has got endless energy for people, for the job that is at hand. And I think going back to your question on these types of guys that, or these types of GMs that didn't grow up in the game, this is a young man's game. And the GM position is a young man's position because of the amount of time and energy that you've got to devote and spend to it. And Alex does a very good job at that. But I think it comes down to his basic personality, and that he's respectful. He has patience for people. He treats people evenly. And that's what makes him such an effective and very good leader.
We are with John Farrell. More phone calls here. Marty is in Aurora. Marty, you're on with John Farrell.
Hey, thank you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with John. And I have a comment and a question, if I may.
Sure.
First of all, my comment is I wanted just to say that, John, you are by far the most articulate Blue Jay manager I've ever heard, and I have a lot of confidence in you. I was a little bit critical at the beginning, but Mike, of course, has always put me in my place, and I got too critical. And I'm really excited about baseball again in Toronto. I think you're going to surprise a lot of people in the future. My question is, how do you go about finding a relief pitcher? Do you look for a trade? Do you try to develop one? What do you look for? And I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
I think he meant a closer as far as the relief pitcher.
What's that, Mike?
I think he was referring specifically to finding a closer, developing a closer.
Good question, because there's a couple of different schools of thought here, and there's a lot of people that think closers are easier to find than some that aren't. But I think the one thing that you have to clearly look for is a swing and miss pitch of some sort, whether that's a finishing split, whether that's a changeup, such as a Doug Jones back in the late 80s and 90s, or whether it's a guy that relies on swing and miss fastball with sheer velocity. A lot of times they come from guys that, if you look at a starter who has had good success to his minor league career, he gets to the major leagues, he's able to go through the lineup one time and then he starts to stumble. Those are some guys that you begin to look at some performance track records that jump off the page saying, you know what, in short stints, three outs, four outs, his stuff, his velocity, his action to his pitches might play up a little bit more in the adrenaline of the ninth inning. Those are the guys you start to earmark or start to pick. The main characteristic that you've got to have in a closer, and this is where you've got to get to know this guy because you have a short-term memory, and I mean that in all sincerity, because the night that he blows a save, he's got to put that behind him and be able to ready to go the next night for when that opportunity arises, and he's not pitching with last night on his mind. He's about getting tonight's three outs and moving on. So physically, you need the guy that's got a wipeout pitch, a put-away pitch of some sort, and then two, mentally, he's got to have short-term memory to wipe the slate clean.
And you know, you're the first person, I remember you talking about this earlier in the season, you're the first person I ever heard suggest that your closer, if he's got that wipeout pitch, doesn't have to be a guy who's got pinpoint control. And you just mentioned it again here because of the situation, the tension in the ninth inning. Hitters will expand. He doesn't have to be perfect.
I truly believe it, because I think the eighth inning pitcher, the setup guy, he is the one that's got to have multiple pitches that he can command for strikes and keep the ball out of the middle of the plate. Scott Downs, perfect example of that. the guy in the ninth inning, because when the hitter gets in the box in the ninth inning, there's no tomorrow. There's no patience to build for the next inning, to kind of wear a guy down or build an inning. They're trying to get it done. So they're going to be more aggressive. They're going to expand the strike zone a little bit more. Now, keep in mind, this guy can't be throwing buckshot at home plate with no clue in the strike zone. But there's more tendency for the hitter in the ninth, I think, to chase out of the strike zone than in the eighth or before.
And that's like opened a whole new world to me. I love that thinking, and it makes so much sense. John Farrell is with us, taking your phone calls. Alan is in Toronto. Alan wants to go a little bit back into John Farrell's pitching days. Say hello to the skipper, Alan.
Hi, John.
Hey, Alan, how are you? This will be a short conversation.
Yeah, Cleveland, they were a bunch of sad sack teams in the 1980s, the late 1980s, but you're... Chief claim to fame was you stopping Paul Molitor in his 39-game hitting streak back in 1987. If you didn't do that, who knows what could have happened, you know, and that's your chief claim to fame, of course. My question
I tend to say that being the manager of the Toronto Blue Jays is my claim to fame rather than a 39-game hitting streak. But you know what was ironic about that whole setting, Alan, is that 5 days prior, I pitched the night game of a day-night doubleheader in Cleveland against Detroit. Rich Yett started game one. He fielded a bunt in the third inning, turned his ankle, had to come out of the game, wasn't able to go 5 days later, and I happened to be in the right place at the right time, and that's how that situation unfolded. So I happen to be a little bit fortunate on that side.
My question to you is the green light on the 3-0 pitch, how do you go about casting your deciding vote? Is it the type of hitter, let's say, Batista or Lynn, they're power hitters, so would you give them a green light as opposed to someone like Mike McCoy, who's not a power hitter, and John McDonald? Would you never give John McDonald a green light on a 3-0 pitch? Or is it depending on the inning of the game, like the score of the game, the inning of the game, all these different factors? What is the number one factor that you decide on giving your hitters a green light on a 3-0 pitch?
You know what, Alan, that's a great question, because there are a number of factors that come into it. One is the type of the hitter at the plate. In general, now this is generally speaking, Jose Bautista is the only guy that I gave the 3-0 swing throughout in any situation throughout the course of the year. Now, there were other situations that came up. Let's say, for instance, Lowry's hitting in the sixth hole, Rasmus is in the seven hole, and we get a left-hander on the mound. Lowry's in a 3-0 count. Rasmus is on deck. We've got a guy in scoring position, tight game. We would be more apt to let Lowry swing the bat 3-0, knowing that the guy behind him with a left-on-left situation, we like the matchup of 3-0, even though it might take away from building a bigger inning. I would let Lowry swing the bat in that situation and not let or put any left-hander in that situation, not just Rasmus. Put another left-hander and take the names off it. But in that situation where you've got the guy on deck who's not as good a matchup, I would rather see the guy swing the bat, try to drive in to run 3-0 count rather than get to the left-on-left.
And to I guess, clarify a little bit for those listening, it's not the same as a hit-and-run. You put a hit-and-run on, you're starting a runner in motion. That the batter has to swing the bat 3-0. You give him the green light. He still is looking for a pitch in a spot, and he's going to take it if he doesn't get it.
See, this is Mike and Al. You know, this is the one thing that we continually talk internally, because this is typically and year in and year out been a very aggressive fastball hitting team. Aggressive swinging, early count contact. We're trying to change some of the culture of that. That doesn't mean we're going to make them passive and look for the walk. That means that there's a benefit to having a relentless at-bat up and down the lineup, because the weakest link for any team is between the fifth and the seventh innings. It's the middle relief, and I'm not being critical of middle relievers because they have a valuable role. But if you can chase that starter in the fifth inning or the sixth inning in the first game of a three-game series, there's ramifications and effect throughout the course of the rest of the series, in addition to tonight's game. So there's a little bit of method to the madness, but yet if we feel like the guy in the box in a 3-0 count has got the ability to be aggressive but slam on the brakes if the ball's off the plate, take the walk, okay, we move on.
We're with Blue Jays manager John Farrell for another few minutes, and we'll do a lot less of me and a lot more of you so we can get as many of you in as we can. Kaz is in Burlington. Kaz, say hello to John Farrell.
Hi, John. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Good, thanks. I just have two quick questions I'd like to ask you. The first one is, as being a first-time manager, what was the biggest shock or adjustment or surprise to you being a first-time manager? And the second one is, we as fans and the media all have opinions of what upgrades this team needs, position-wise or whatever. What do you feel that this team needs to improve, or what areas in the next season to be a better team?
Because the biggest change that I went through in spring training was going from a career of preventing offense, both as a pitcher and a pitching coach, to one now trying to think the other way. Look at the game in a mirror and look at ways to create. I knew what gave pitchers difficulty. I knew it was more difficult to prepare against a more diverse type of offense. So communicating that message, getting guys to buy in, getting guys to believe it, and then going out and drilling it and carrying it over into games, that was the initial biggest challenge. Going forward from spring training on is getting a read on every individual position player. You know, I've got more of an innate sense with a pitcher, what they're going through, but trying to understand the mindset and the mind of the position player, that was an ongoing thing. That'll probably always be ongoing. I'm not afraid to say that. That'll probably be an evolving situation of getting to know guys individually, what their needs are, when they need a blow, et cetera, those types of things. Going into the offseason, I felt like a number one, a starter was our most pressing need. We need to pitch more innings out of our starting rotation, whether that's a bounce back of Brett Cecil next year, whether that's continued improvement by Brandon Morrow. Ricky Romero, I thought, took a major step forward and had one hell of a year for us. Henderson Alvarez, a bright young pitcher, got into the seventh inning routinely, but we need to pitch more innings out of the rotation, and certainly we need bullpen help. We've got an answer at second base and a hole that's there. So we've got to address pitching. We need a second baseman to be solidified. But if you're to ask me if we're only able to get one thing, I'd like another dominant starting pitcher.
That sounds good. Everyone wants another dominant starting pitcher. That helps incredibly. And you do have, and we've talked about, and I know here's me again instead of the callers, but we've talked about stuff, and Alan Ashby and I talk about this all the time. You put five guys out there in Romero, Morrow, Alvarez, Dustin McGowan, and Kyle Drabek. Stuff-wise, you're right there with pretty much anybody in the big leagues.
I would totally agree with you. But stuff gets you there, or stuff gets you to the mound. What keeps you into the seventh inning is the ability to execute it. Mm-hmm. That's where we've got to make another step forward.
James is in Toronto. James, you're on with the skipper, John Farrell.
Greetings.
Hello.
Thank you. I'm frustrated. I'm very happy that you're on the show this evening, Mr. Farrell, but I'm just wondering what your expectations are, because frankly, I bought less tickets last year just because I seemed to me to be a major contradiction in the plan when Bautista is identified, you know, a mature player as the centerpiece of the franchise. And yet, I'm wondering what attempt is going to be made to surround him with the caliber of players that's going to give the Blue Jays a chance to win next year. Is that your expectation, to actually compete? Because we hear so much, you know, that standard Toronto whining about how, well, we can't compete in the American League East. But look, Tampa Bay made the playoffs. St. Louis and Texas are now in the World Series. So are your expectations to compete sooner or later?
Without a doubt, sooner. And I can honestly tell you that if the sentiment of being in the American League East is one of an insurmountable challenge, that might be on the outside. Internally, that is not a crutch or an obstacle that we look at as being insurmountable. We feel very, very confident about the young group that is in place. I will tell you this. What you just brought up about Jose being the centerpiece and building around it, Alex feels that same way. There's a window of opportunity here with Jose being in the middle of that window to build around it. And I'm not, you know, on this show to put more pressure on Alex or to say that, you know, this guy is coming or that guy is coming. But I can tell you in our conversations, Alex is very well aware of that. So is Paul Beeston. So is everyone that's in this organization that knows that, you know what, we're on the threshold of something, I think, relatively special here, because we have a guy like Jose as one of our leaders, because we've got some youth that can be added to this mix. And Alex has got a very clear plan that I think people that pay attention to it see the pieces being put into place and can follow it as we go forward. And the one thing he's not done, he's not mortgaged the future on today. And I think that's the only way to get to the point of contending and then the ability to sustain it going forward.
And there is a lot, there's a lot of future. Now, it's not all going to make the majors, but you were a farm director with the Cleveland Indians before you went to the Red Sox, and you know how much that stuff is coveted, and the Blue Jays Cup seems to be almost overflowing with stuff that everybody else wants, and that's the kind of stuff that can help you get to where you need to go in a hurry.
Well, it can, Mike, but I think the biggest, you know, that stuff that you refer to are young players that are prospects. Let's not confuse that. They're prospects. And until they come to the big leagues and start to perform, now their value starts to skyrocket. We're on the cusp of that. And this isn't trying to sell the public a bill of goods. This is to try to say that there's a major step taken forward this year. And there's some pieces that certainly have to be added. We talked about the pitching. That's where we have to upgrade. That's where we have to improve upon. A lot of people have to point to the 25 or 26 saves blown and say, well, you know what, if you just won 10 of those, it'll be a 91-win team. Well, yeah, that's nice to say on paper. But we've got to put the group together to go out and do that. And every effort is being made to do just that.
We talked about those blown saves a lot over the course of this year. I think you actually did win 8 games in which you blew saves. And I don't know if this means anything, but you were, I want to say, 11-3 when the other guy blew a save too. So in the overall, in a game in which a save was blown, the Jays were a game over 500. Do you think that means anything, or does that mean that you guys need to protect your back end a little bit better so you can take more advantage when the other guy doesn't?
Well, the thing that we have to do is, and this is what every contending team does, when they get the lead, they don't give it up. And I know that there's going to be times when you do, but it can be demoralizing to the everyday player. And I'm not, again, not being critical of pitching, but the situation that we looked at back on this year, we came back, I think, 39 different times this year for wins. And when you have a lead late and it's given up, that there's a sting to that. And there's a little bit of a carryover effect, even though our guys did a very good job of separating and putting yesterday behind them. But when you have that 1-2 run lead in the 7th-8th inning to nail it down, I tell you what, that goes a long way of growing the confidence in that clubhouse.
We're with the skipper, John Farrell, and you've given us quite a bit of your time. We appreciate it a lot. We're going to go watch or listen to a baseball game right now, but I want to specifically thank you. You're we have players on, and we have a host of players on every year, and your best player, Jose Bautista, is going to come on with us tomorrow. We've got coaches as well. You are the first manager who's ever appeared on this show, so I appreciate that a lot. I know the callers appreciate that a lot. I hope you have a productive off season. Look forward to seeing you in Dallas at the winter meetings and then in Dunedin again. And thank you so much for this.
All right, Mike. I tell you what, this is an exciting offseason, and I think we should have a lot of confidence in what Alex will be capable of doing this offseason. I think his track record in a short period of time has suggested that. Things are headed in the right direction. It never happens as fast as we all want it to, but I feel like we're making strides towards that end.
We are all looking very much forward to seeing what's cooking this offseason. Thanks a lot, John.
Okay, Mike. See you, man.
There he is, the Blue Jays manager, John Farrell, taking your calls on the Blue Jay A Day pregame show.